Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Josh Koppel for the U.S. government defendants. I'd like to reserve 6 minutes for rebuttal. Nearly 40 years ago, in United States v. Fausto, the Supreme Court established that the CSRA creates a comprehensive and exclusive scheme for review of federal personnel actions. And Fausto held that employees who are denied review under that scheme, including probationary employees, are simply out of luck. They cannot bypass the CSRA's remedial scheme by filing suit in district court. That holding clearly forecloses district court jurisdiction in this suit. Plaintiff's complaint clearly challenges federal personnel actions, specifically the termination of probationary employees. And plaintiffs sought the reversal of those personnel actions, specifically reinstatement of those employees. And although the district court didn't ultimately grant reinstatement, it imposed an injunction that restrains the personnel action of employing agencies in numerous other ways. Among other things, it requires agencies to update terminated employees' personnel files, requires agencies to send letters to terminated former employees with information about the circumstances of their termination, limits statements that agencies can make if they're called to provide a reference for terminated employees.
Counsel, can I cut to the chase for at least for my notes? I don't mean to interrupt, but it's just so central for my review of the case that I want to put it out there so you can have as much time as you want to engage in. It seems to me your arguments really are centered on the nature of this claim, which of course is part of the Thunder Basin test. And you've taken the position very consistently that the nature of the claim here is, as you said, a challenge to the termination decisions. I take it that's the government's position today.
That's right.
Okay. And my read is that the reason you make that assertion is grounded in the prayer for relief. Is that right?
Partly, but not only.
Okay. So what's the other reason?
So first of all, on the prayer for relief, Elgin also says, you know, engages with the relief that was sought in that case. And so that clearly is relevant. But I think it's also the nature of the claim here. So plaintiff's claim, you know, the allegations of the claim. So plaintiffs allege that OPM directed the termination of probationary employees and that the federal agencies who employed the employees went ahead and terminated probationary employees at OPM's direction. They allege that the agencies then gave what they call a pretextual reason for the termination. So all of those allegations, right, their legal claim is essentially that the termination of probationary employees, in other words, this personnel action was done unlawfully because it wasn't done pursuant to statutory authority. And so, you know, I don't think it's only the prayer for relief. It's also that claim. There's no way really to formulate that claim without breaking.
Let me just push back on that a little bit because I'm not so sure I buy that. I appreciate that part of the reason for your position that this is a challenge to the terminations is the prayer for relief. And of course, in the prayer for relief, they do two things. The first is they seek a declaration that OPM's program requiring termination was unlawful. And then the second is to set it aside. Correct? So let me ask you this. If they only requested a declaration that the action was unlawful, would that have to be channeled?
I believe it would, but I think there are some steps before that. So first of all, plaintiff's injury, what they allege their injury is in their complaint.
So I'm going to interrupt you because I think you didn't get to my question. I don't want you to elide the question.
Yep.
You said that would need to be challenged. A purely a claim for declaratory relief would have to be challenged, and I just don't want to lose that thread. Why do you think that would have to be challenged?
Yeah, and I
said challenged. I meant channeled. Forgive me.
Yeah, that's right. And you know what I was just trying to say very briefly was that if that's all that plaintiffs sought, I don't think that there would be redressability, and so they're necessarily seeking more. But even a claim,
hold on, you're just going really fast here. We're going to take plenty of time with this argument. So let's change the hypothetical. Make the, if you would, the first prayer for relief a request for a declaration that the action was unlawful. And then in this hypothetical, just make the second prayer for relief a request that there is injunctive relief so that prospectively the agency could never do that again. So now we've got standing, all right? And in my hypothetical, there's a request for relief that is redressable. Would that have to be channeled?
It would. So the CSRA scheme envisions that there are very limited circumstances where a plaintiff or where employees can challenge an OPM rule or action facially, preemptively, before it's been translated into concrete personnel actions. And this is under 5 U.S.C. 1204 A and F. Basically, the OPM action can be challenged for violation of Section 2302B, prohibited personnel actions, including discrimination, nepotism, and the like. For other challenges to OPM actions, those can only be brought after they're translated into federal personnel actions. And once that happens, so in this case, for example, the termination of an employee, now setting aside that these are probationary employees who can't appeal to the MSPB, suppose it was a tenured employee that was fired at the direction of OPM, they could appeal that termination to the MSPB, and the MSPB has authority to set aside that termination if it was done for unlawful reasons, for example, at the direction of an agency that didn't have statutory authority, or if the reasons provided were arbitrary and capricious. For example, as plaintiffs allege that the employee's performance was cited as the reason, if the MSPB found that that was pretextual, then that could be set aside.
Can I ask?
So can I just finish up? Forgive me, Judge Bress. I just want to clarify. Your answer seems to go to our hypothetical plaintiffs who are employees of OPM. Is that right?
No, that's not. So if this was an employee of, for example, the Veterans Administration, but if the person was terminated at the direction of OPM, they could appeal their termination to the MSPB. And the MSPB then has authority to look at all the circumstances concerning the termination, including whether it was done at OPM's behest.
So these employees, of course, could not, because they're probationary employees who are defined as right outside of this. They're not defined as employees, correct?
That's correct. So that is the reason that these employees cannot appeal. But that is Congress.
I'll take yes for an answer. Judge Bress, go right ahead.
Yeah, I was curious for the federal unions here. What avenues do the government think they could pursue? There was references to these unfair labor charges, and then also the grievance procedures under the collective bargaining agreements. Could the arguments that are being made through this litigation be vindicated in either of those two other processes?
So as a merits matter, we think no. The allegations in the complaint are that the termination of probationary employees interfered with the plaintiff's right to represent their employees.
I'm not talking about a merits matter. I'm just talking about a forum matter. So could they bring an unfair labor charge and make this claim?
So, yes. I believe they could.
How about under the grievance, the collective bargaining agreements? There was some dispute, I think, in some of the briefing about whether they would cover this or not. And I guess my first question is, would they cover it? And then second, if it doesn't, does that matter?
So the collective bargaining agreements, as far as I'm aware, none of them provide for procedures prior to the termination of probationary employees. But I think that's a merits question. If the termination of probationary employees was done in violation of the collective bargaining agreements, if that had been bargained, if some protections had been bargained for, that could absolutely be raised in front of the FLRA. So again, to the extent that they can't go to the FLRA, that's just because they don't have a merits claim, right? It wasn't put in the collective bargaining agreement. I don't think that's relevant to the question whether this claim has to be channeled.
What is the government's position on whether this court should be applying the Thunder Basin factors to this dispute, or whether those factors are not relevant in the context of a CSRA claim?
I think they are relevant. Elgin cited the Thunder Basin factors. I don't think this court needs to go through that analysis because Elgin has done the work for the court, and this court can then just apply Elgin and apply Fausto. But I do think that the Thunder Basin elements are, underlie Elgin, and so that they are ultimately relevant to the CSRA analysis.
How do you reconcile that answer with the one you gave a moment ago, where Elgin talks about covered employees challenging a covered action? And I think we've just established that probationary employees aren't covered employees under this scheme.
So So that's exactly Fausto, right? Fausto was non-covered employees because they were accepted non-preference employees who are specifically excluded. And Fausto said they don't have rights under the CSRA, but that doesn't allow them to then go to district court, which would in fact privilege them over those with rights under the CSRA. And Fausto actually specifically called out probationary employees as being in the same position and said they too don't have rights under the CSRA, but that doesn't allow them to go to district court.
We're not communicating. A minute ago, you've agreed that these folks are not covered employees. Is that right?
They do not have rights to appeal to the MSPB under the CSRA. They are certainly.
So how is this? You're hesitating. I wasn't intended to be a trick question. So what am I missing there?
So Congress had these employees in mind when it enacted the CSRA, and they are provided for in certain. I believe they do have certain protections. What they do not have is appeal rights to the MSPB. And so I guess
we're talking about those. Well, you're talking about channeling, and it seems to me under the Thunder Basin test, which we are obligated to conduct, that's a very relevant circumstance. We have to figure that out, and I can't see in your briefing, and then just a minute ago, you were relying not on Fausto, you were relying on Elgin and for the proposition that we didn't really even need to do a Thunder Basin analysis. So I'm trying to make sure I understand your position on that point.
Yeah, so I think that the court doesn't need to do a Thunder Basin analysis because the work has been done for it in Fausto and Elgin and all these other cases that follow from those. Fausto establishes that where Congress excluded employees from the appeal rights granted in the CSRA, they cannot then bypass the CSRA scheme and go to district court, essentially asserting a right to go to district court that is not that those with rights under the CSRA wouldn't have. And so Fausto really addresses probationary employees in particular. I don't think there's any question that if a probationary employee is terminated, take OPM out of this. If an agency terminates a probationary employee, for some arbitrary reason, I don't think there's any question the probationary employee does not have the right to appeal to the MSPB, nor does the probationary employee have a right to file in district court.
Well, it's difficult in this conversation to separate what we're trying to get at per Judge Bess's point is just jurisdiction and not merit. So it feels like a slippery slope, but we're trying to keep those two things separate. Let me ask you this. Do you agree that the actions that are complained of, OPM's actions that are the subject of the complaint here, were all antecedent to the terminations?
I don't think so. I think it's the terminations that they are complaining of, the termination the direction of OPM.
Paragraphs 185 through 187 talk about the APA claim, and they talk about the actions that OPM took, and it seems to me they are all antecedent. These all go to, very clearly, to the OPA exceeding its authority granted by Congress.
I think that plaintiffs have clearly tried to structure their case to create a distinction in order to avoid what I think is a very clear channeling problem here. But first of all, as I already explained, I don't think it matters whether OPM's action was precedent to the terminations, because as I explained, the CSRA envisions that that any such actions that precede the personnel action will only be challenged on review of the personnel action itself.
Can I stop you there? Because I do think it matters, and I'm trying to get you to answer the question respectfully, please. Do you agree that all of the actions complained of, that the plaintiffs complain about at paragraphs 185 to 187 were antecedent to the terminations? I'm not trying to be difficult, but I am trying to make sure we have clear communication.
So I'm looking at 185 to 187, and this references the actions of OPM.
Uh-huh.
Which I think necessarily brings in earlier allegations in the complaint. And I don't think that those are necessarily all antecedent to the terminations themselves. So, for example, on page ER-47, this is paragraph 8, they allege that tens of thousands of probationary employees across dozens of agencies have already been terminated in the summary assembly line fashion directed by OPM. That's the personnel actions itself. The next allegations, OPM perpetrated one of the most massive employment frauds in the history of this country, telling tens of thousands of workers that they are being fired for performance reasons when they most certainly were not. So if this is OPM, if what plaintiffs are challenging is OPM or OPM through the agencies telling employees why they were fired, that's a personnel action.
Well, so the district court has ruled on all of those claims, right? I think that the government's position was that OPM didn't take these actions. And I'm probably oversimplifying that. But those were, the government lost those claims at summary judgment, and they're not before us, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So we're really just trying to do this, I guess, more antiseptic look at the nature of the claim. Hence my focus on paragraphs 185 through 187 to try to figure out if those are, because that's the APA claim. And it seems to me those are antecedent to the terminations themselves. But I've made that point, and opposing counsel can say what they have to say. I think I have your answer.
What would have happened? Go ahead, finish, and then I have a question.
Yeah, I think it is important to remember the relief that they request. In their original complaint, they did not include the agency defendants. And the district court said, essentially, this is at the TRO hearing, how can I order relief against them? You ask for a reinstatement. How can I order that if the employing agencies aren't defendants here? And the plaintiff said, well, they were acting in concert with OPM. And the district court said, the quote, come on, like that's kind of ridiculous. And plaintiff said, okay, we can join the agencies here. The agencies are joined. They're plainly defendants in this suit. And 80%, more than 80% of the injunction is directed at the employing agencies themselves. This is clearly a complaint about personnel action. It's clearly relief about personnel action and undoing that certain of those personnel actions.
Can I ask you, just turning back to the Thunder Basin test, where we're directed to look at the nature of the claim, can you tell me what is it about Thunder Basin that causes us or directs us to look at the prayer for relief?
So I can't say anything in Thunder Basin at the moment. I have that in front of me, but Elgin in particular, when it looks at that Thunder Basin factor, does say what plaintiffs seek is, you know, plaintiffs have brought this suit as a way to undo the personnel action to obtain reinstatement and back pay. So Elgin in applying Thunder Basin certainly gets into the prayer for relief.
Can I ask from a channeling perspective, what would have happened if the plaintiffs had only sued OPM?
So I think that the suit would also have been channeled because, again, they're not alleging that OPM's action violated Section 2302B, which, again, is the only way to kind of bring this preemptory facial challenge to an OPM regulation. So the only thing that they could do is wait for that OPM directive to be implemented. It had already been implemented by the time they filed their complaint. So really the only way for them to bring the challenge was through an appeal of the personnel action, and then MSPB can review you know, any OPM involvement in the challenge personnel action.
So in that world, I think the one you're describing is a world in which the unions, anyone with any skin in the game here, would never be in a position to seek declaratory judgment and prospective injunctive relief, saying that action was wrong, that action exceeded your statutory authority, and don't do it again.
I think that's right. And I think that that is exactly what the CSRA scheme envisions. You know, if an agency on its own behest started terminating employees for completely arbitrary reasons, there would be, I don't think that there is prospective relief in the MSPB. If there is, the relief is only through the MSPB. I'm actually not certain if the MSPB can grant that kind of prospective relief.
Let me just check. I don't know. We've let Judge Van Dyke get in a question sideways here.
No, I'm good.
Nothing. Anything further, Judge Bryce?
Not at this time.
Okay. I think you wanted to reserve a bit of time. So.
Yeah. Yes, okay. Thank you.
You bet. Can we do something so that we'll be able to see Oh, here she comes. Okay.
Magically go down.
Okay, that I was alarmed.
My height.
Now we can see you. Okay.
Thank you and good morning.
Council appearing remotely. You can see council in the courtroom, is that right?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. Go right ahead.
Great. Thank you. And good morning, Your Honors. Danielle Leonard for Plaintiffs Appellees. The government's argument, the primary argument on appeal, as you've been discussing with counsel for the government, is that the CSRA removed authority or jurisdiction from the federal courts to consider OPM's unlawful directives to other agencies because they involved probationary employees. They engage in what I'll call a two-step here. First, under Thunder Basin, saying, at times there's a channel, but not really. He's admitted, opposing counsel has admitted very clearly there is no channel for probationary employees. So we should start our analysis at that point. Under Thunder Basin, there is no meaningful judicial review at the end because there is no channel. So what do they do with that?
But I guess question is, does that then matter, right? Because we have Fausto.
That is exactly the two-step, Your Honor. It goes straight to Fausto. And the question under Fausto is, did the text and structure of the statute overcome the presumption of judicial review, and in particular what the Supreme Court has called in case after case resistance to making a negative implication from silence, a negative implication from providing one remedy. You don't imply that another remedy is not available. And they conflate, in their argument, they conflate individual employee claims through the Chapter 75 process that Congress addressed in the CSRA. And I'll give you under Fausto that the rationale that applied to the non-preference.
So can I?
Sure.
Actually, so it seems like the way you're framing the argument today is to say it's very dependent upon the fact that they're probationary employees that essentially don't have a remedy under this. What if this did not involve probationary employees at all, but it was just about employees that did have a remedy? Would that because there's a second question after this, but would that seem to the way you're framing the argument make a big difference to your channeling argument? Because you started by saying there is no channel for the probationary employees because they essentially don't have a remedy. So I'm basically asking you, if we assume there was a channel, and one way we can do that is say, if this whole thing was about non-probationary employees, if we assume there was a channel, is that what's driving your argument? Because that raises a separate question, but maybe answer the first question.
Sure. I think of course, the court's analysis should take into account whether there's a channel. That matters a lot. And if there were a channel, that would be AFGE v. Trump. The argument was there's a channel there, and this court has already addressed that. But there is no channel here, and let me explain why under Fausto that matters and what the outcome should be.
So that leads me to the second question. The problem that I'm struggling with that way of approaching this question is, you know, the difference between probationary and non-probationary employees and not giving probationary employees a channel seems to be an intentional part of a scheme to give more rights to non-probationary employees and less to probationary employees, which is kind of intuitive to all of us in like a general sense. But this is what your counsel on the other side was kind of getting at, was that if you frame it the way you're framing it and you start from the, say, because they don't have a statutory agency remedy, that really puts a thumb on the scale that we need to have judicial review. That seems to turn it upside down, because now you're giving more rights to probationary employees than non. So that's what I'm struggling with a little bit.
It's not that we're giving more rights. The question is whether there's judicial review for OPM's action. And the question that Your Honor is asking is just the type of question that the Supreme Court answered in a case called Bowen v. Mission Academy of Family Physicians. In that case, in Bowen, there had been an earlier Supreme Court ruling that the individual determinations under Medicare Part B were impliedly precluded. That's a case called Erica. Fausto relies heavily on Erica to say individual determinations, proliferation of lawsuits, we can understand Congress didn't want that. Fausto, with respect to the CSRA, is just like Erica with respect to Medicare Part B. After Erica, there's a case called Bowen. And the question in Bowen was, is the APA challenge to the agency's regulation directing how those individual determinations should be made is that impliedly precluded, just like Erica? And the Supreme Court said no. That is a quintessentially different claim. And just because the individual determinations are impliedly precluded, that does not necessarily lead to the conclusion under the text and structure of this statute that the challenge, the APA challenge to the directive, the centralized directive, that determines those individual determinations. And in that case—
The question I would have then, I didn't mean to cut you off, but the question I would have is, you know, there's a lot of CSRA case law out there, like from the D.C. Circuit, talking about how, well, we can't have APA claims be brought in a way that would circumvent the CSRA. And actually, our court has had some cases, too, they're older, that say sort of the same thing. So how is what you're saying consistent with that body of law?
First of all, with respect to the Ninth Circuit, all of those cases are about individual claims. And it could be perfectly consistent for the court to understand that Congress did not intend under Fausto for individual employees to go through challenges, like in Fausto, where they were kind of tinkering with the amount of back pay, but also at the same time allow the APA claim challenging the centralized directive.
And this is a good line of argument. So if the plaintiffs here were an individual probationary employee, do you agree their claim would need to be channeled if they were bringing the exact same lawsuit that we have here?
I think that their individual claims would be precluded, Your Honor, unfortunately.
Wait, if it's the very same claim?
If they're not, I'm sorry, I missed the end part. If they're bringing the very same claim.
Yeah, if this lawsuit were John Smith against OPM and his employing agency, would this lawsuit be precluded?
If the exact same claim challenging the under the APA OPM's actions, the answer is no, and that is Bowen, because it was the.
Don't see how that we could say that though, consistent with this case law that I referenced before.
Because, Your Honor, so if you're referencing the D.C. Circuit case law, I think that there is a distinction between the D.C. Circuit and the Ninth Circuit on the point of whether these are the same type of claim. And I think it is a quintessentially different type of claim to challenge the centralized directive. And in Bowen, the plaintiff was an association of individual doctors who would have been precluded under that scheme. And they could bring the APA challenge to the centralized directive if they were challenging OPM. And that is, as we've noted, the claim that is before this court, not a challenge to the individual application by the agency to those individuals.
Hey, it's a challenge to OPM. How about the D.C. Circuit case law, like Fornaro and Ahuja, some of which were written by current members of the Supreme Court that say, well, we can't use the CSRA as a basis to we can't go around the CSRA to have a district court challenge to system-wide OPM policy.
So in Ahuja, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but Ahuja, that was a OPM adjudication under the federal retirement statute that was directly given to OPM, and then there was a direct appeal to the MSPB. That's a channeling case. That is not the same thing as this case where there is the argument is being made that the challenge to a government-wide OPM directive to other agencies exceeded authority, and that is somehow outside of judicial review. There was going to be judicial review under Ahuja at the end of the day, and here the government is arguing very clearly there is no judicial review for OPM's actions. That is wrong under Bowen.
Well, the government also said there could be opportunities for federal unions to pursue claims under other pathways, and I take it you disagree.
We do disagree because I think they're misinterpreting the statute and the scope of FLRA jurisdiction there. The ULPs, which they're pointing to, if you read the statutory provision of it's 7116A, 7 and 8, they simply do not allow the FLRA to consider the type of claim that is at issue here against OPM. And the reason for that is because unions are not permitted to bargain over government-wide instructions. They cannot bring a failure to bargain challenge before the FLRA.
Union not argue that employment actions were unlawful based on essentially statutory authority?
They No, Your Honor. They are only allowed to bring certain ULPs before the FLRA, and they are allowed to argue that there is a violation of certain provisions of the CSRA, absolutely. But that's not the claim here. The claim, sorry, the they're allowed to argue, let me be more specific, they're allowed to argue that there have been violations of the FSLMRS, Chapter 71. But the claim here is that OPM exceeded its statutory authority. This is the claim that is the basis of the judgment, that it was contrary to law because OPM did not have the authority to direct other agencies to engage in these actions.
Oh, right, but is it really not the case that you couldn't a union couldn't claim it's an unfair labor practice for an employing agency to be operating at the directive of some non-authoritative actor, whether it be OPM or somebody else? That would seem like a unfair labor charge.
It's not, Your Honor. The parameters of the unfair labor charges under the FLRA are defined by Congress there. And what the government is arguing, what the government's attorney just very clearly argued, is we are making a negative implication from that. If the scope of the jurisdiction...
So
Can we just get the answer to finish your answer, if
I'm right about the scope of 7116, which I believe we clearly are, that those unfair labor practices don't go beyond the statutory violations of the labor statutes, which this is not, that is not the argument here. If we're right about that, what the government is arguing is you take that channel, which does not include this, and you make the same leap to the conclusion that no other type of claim can be brought in federal court to challenge OPM's actions because it's brought by a union. That's wrong. There's never been case law.
What they would say is, you know, that's just a further example of Fausto.
That is exactly what they would say, and they would be wrong under Bowen, Your Honor. And they would also be wrong because there is no textual or structural indication in the statute we're talking about, which is what you need, that Congress that enacted in 1978 this statute intended for OPM's actions to evade judicial review. That's what they need. They need something in the actual statute beyond just the fact that certain things were sent to the MSPB and the FLRA. What the Supreme Court has said time and again, this is the Macho Wisha, I'm going to get that name wrong, the Patchick case. The Potawatomi Indians case. Subject matter is not enough. Even overlapping remedy is not enough. We do not, where we're talking about complete preclusion, we do not impliedly preclude lightly and just based on subject matter and overlapping remedies alone. There aren't even overlapping remedies here. The provision of one remedy does not impliedly preclude the other. And
what about the government's position that, you know, a lot of the relief that's being asked for sounds like kind of employment based, if you will?
So our argument in response to that is the government is conflating jurisdiction with scope of relief, clearly. They made these arguments with respect to Rule 19. They made these arguments with respect to the scope of relief for the claims against OPM in the court below, and they have not brought those arguments before the court. They are fishing for a jurisdictional ruling, and they're using remedy issues to try to get there. That's not appropriate.
Well, I think what they're saying is, you know, this is further indication that the claims sound in the scope of the area that we think the CSRA usually covers. So how would you address that point?
I think that's subject matter based argument. It's not just about whether it's the type of things that the CSRA, it's about what Congress specifically did in this statute, what channels and what remedies it provided, and then against the backdrop of the APA, which very clearly provides a claim to challenge on OPM's unlawful actions. Against that backdrop, did they take it away? And you need something in the text and structure of the statute to overcome what the Supreme Court has said is the command of judicial review. And they haven't identified it. We've identified textual indications that Congress did intend OPM's government-wide actions to be covered by the APA. They mentioned the APA several times, in particular saying OPM is subject to it. There's no...
Counsel.
Please.
I keep trying to get back to Judge Van Dyke.
Yeah, moments passed. It's fine.
That's probably my fault, so no, I apologize.
Did you have a question you were trying to ask?
No, moments passed. Fine.
Can I ask a different question?
Go ahead.
Thank you. what's left at stake in this case? And hopefully the government can address the same point.
Meaning what relief awarded under the APA against OPM is still...
What is the ongoing relevance of the district court's injunction? Because I saw the district court, you know, reference something in its one of its orders saying, well, there's a lot of water under the bridge and, you know, time has passed. We heard argument in this case a year ago and we had some of the same questions then. So I still have some of those questions, probably even more so now, as to what is the import of the district court's injunction going forward?
Well, the district court enjoined OPM from doing what it had done. It held unlawful and set aside OPM's directive to the other federal agencies to fire all of their probationary employees under the false pretext of performance. That is an ongoing injunction against OPM. That is the reason why the claim against OPM was brought in the first place, is because OPM did this. It did it in the early days of the administration. A lot of water has been under the bridge. It was a very, as the record made clear, it was a very chaotic thing that OPM did at the outset. It was, as the district court held, completely unlawful. And there was very real concern that OPM would simply take that action again. And there is an injunction in place preventing OPM from doing that. And that is quintessential APA relief against OPM's action. The ancillary relief that the court awarded against the Rule 19 federal defendant agencies was part of what the court said was the APA relief of setting aside OPM's action. We can debate whether the relief should have extended that far. The government certainly didn't think so below, but they have waived that argument on appeal, and they are trying to, they've conceded it. They're trying to convert that into a jurisdictional decision, and that's simply not an appropriate move.
Did you request prospective injunctive relief?
Do we request prospective injunction relief? So on the APA claim, yes, we requested under 706, we requested that it be held unlawful and set aside. And in the setting aside, I believe an order that OPM not direct agencies to fire their probationary employees under false pretenses is part of the setting aside.
Why wouldn't that be enough? If there were, go back to a hypothetical, because we can look at the complaint and see what you requested, I guess. But if a complaint requested, as does your first prayer for relief, a declaration that the action was unlawful, and in the second prayer for relief requested only an injunction going forward. Don't do that again, in other words. Why wouldn't that be enough?
Well, because the agencies had in the interim taken steps to implement, and Judge Alsup...
My question is, why wouldn't that be enough for jurisdiction?
Oh, that is enough for jurisdiction. Absolutely, Your Honor. Sorry.
I appreciate that there's a concern that it went farther, and to Judge Bress's point, and I guess yours, some of the additional relief that requested was granted, some of it was not. I'm just wondering why it matters.
I think that is absolutely enough for jurisdiction, Your Honor, and that is the question that is before the court. Is there jurisdiction over this claim against OPM?
My colleagues have more questions. No, I don't think we do.
Thank you.
But we can't see opposing counsel very well. Here he comes. In case you're wondering, in the courtroom, sir, the screen goes down and you sort of disappear, and now you're coming back up.
Okay.
Okay, go right ahead.
It's like I'm sitting and standing.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. I think that plaintiffs have conceded at this point that what they're asking for is a circuit split. I think they conceded that under D.C. Circuit case law, like Fornero, written by, as Judge Bress pointed out, Chief Justice Roberts, I think that they've conceded that this claim has to be channeled or is precluded by the CSRA. And they say that there's some old Ninth Circuit case law supporting them. I certainly don't think there is. I don't think there is any circuit split on this issue. I think that the case law is very clear that this kind of claim is precluded.
They focused a lot, that we heard a lot about Bowen.
Yeah. I think the primary answer is that the Medicare Act is not the CSRA. And the Supreme Court has differentiated between the two. The Supreme Court addressed similar arguments in Elgin, where there was a facial programmatic challenge to the Military Selective Service Act. And the court said that even that kind of facial challenge has to be channeled through the MSPB. I think the court has treated the CSRA and the Medicare Act differently.
What is the ongoing import of the district court's orders?
So the agencies are prohibited from... So the agencies have been required to tell the terminated probationary employees that they were not terminated based on performance and prohibited from saying anything to the contrary. If a new prospective employer calls the agency and asks, why was the employee terminated? The agencies are restricted in what they can say. So I think that there is clearly some ongoing injury, that this case is not moot. And so, the court certainly has appellate jurisdiction to decide the jurisdictional issue here.
Counsel, what's the status of National Treasury Employees Union?
Is this the, there are a number of NTEU cases. Do you mean the one challenging the executive order with regard to?
The one in the D.C. Circuit, unions? I think it was authored by Judge Katsas, and it originally held that the CSRA precluded jurisdiction, but it went en banc. It's back down, I think, now. Is that, it's not ringing a bell? Or not? I'm not giving you enough to differentiate it.
I'm sorry. I don't think I'm familiar with the case.
Okay. I think I might be out of questions. One moment. If you could just give us a minute. I think we all have pretty extensive notes here.
If I might make one very brief final point.
You bet. Go right ahead. Question.
At the very least, the court should vacate the injunction with regard, insofar as it reaches the employing agencies. Plaintiffs suggest that we forfeited that argument. It's about the district court's jurisdiction over those federal agencies and jurisdiction to issue an injunction binding those employing agencies. And that's exactly the argument we've been making all along.
So can I just maybe ask, this is the perilous question that may open a Pandora's box, but I don't think I ever heard the answer to the question about if by my read, claim one asked for the prayer for relief, that's the declaratory relief that the action was unlawful, and that if claim two, you think it's too broad, there's difference of opinion about what is packed in there, but there's certainly, I think, a request for an injunction that OPM not do that again. And again, for purposes of this appeal, those actions have been decided against the government, and those aren't on appeal. So we're just looking at the nature of the claim here. If the complaint had that, just that, if I read it just that way, why would this claim have to be channeled?
Because the CSRA envisions that only a limited set of challenges can be brought to peremptory facial challenges can be brought to OPM action. Again, this is under 1204 A and F.
So again,
only challenges under 2302 B can be brought to OPM actions. Otherwise, the employee has to wait for the OPM rule, directive, whatever it is, to be cemented into a personnel action. And then the employee can, assuming the employee has appeal rights under the MSPB, the employee can appeal that employment action. And then the MSPB, in reviewing the employment action, can also review the antecedent OPM action.
Okay, so back to the question about in your world, how would this action that the agency, OPM, exceeded its authority, how would that ever get aired? And I think the answer to your question is that an individual employee, or you can have a set of those employees, I suppose, would have to wait for the action to materialize in an individual termination decision and then take it up individually. That's your response?
That is right.
Okay. And so the fact that OPM is not the employer as to most of these employees, right? And typically what we'd be looking at under the statutory scheme is that the responding agency is the employing agency. And the answer to that is what?
So it doesn't make a difference that the employing agency would be the respondent in the MSPB. I'm trying to get, sure I understand the question, but
fair enough. Maybe it wasn't a good question. I'm trying to get to the universe, and maybe you can point me to a case where there's an example where the MSPB has declared unlawful, that a non-employer agency has exceeded its statutory authority. Has that ever happened?
I believe we cite some cases in our reply brief. If you'll give me just a moment.
Okay. And I'm just trying to tease out cases where OPM is not the employer.
So where MSPB has determined that an employment agency has exceeded its statutory authority?
A non-employer agency has exceeded.
A non-employer.
Right.
So Cronin, the Cronin decision that we cite, for example, held that an OPM action or an OPM regulation, I believe it was, had unlawfully delegated authority to the employing agency. And so that is an example where the MSPB looked beyond the actions of the employing agency and held that OPM's regulation was unlawful.
Cronin?
Yeah. Yes, I believe that the case is Cronin, and I believe there's some others that we cite as well in our reply and certiorari reply.
I'll look again. Judge, why would it make any question?
Yeah, I mean, if I may make two quick questions. I guess one is, I'm not sure why it would make any difference. I mean, if the employee was someone who was otherwise eligible to pursue relief before the MSPB, isn't the employee allowed to make whatever arguments he or she has as to why they were unlawfully terminated? And one of those could be some external body, you know, took control of the agency and ordered me fired, and you can't do that. And that's an argument that's exactly vindicated.
But they would, if I could just clarify, so they wouldn't, under this hypothetical that Judge Bress is posing, that employee wouldn't have a claim really against the employer agency.
Well, the claim is against the employer agency.
Well, sort of.
The claim is you, the employer agency, acted pursuant to an unlawful directive. And the directive was unlawful because the person that gave the directive, OPM, had no authority to do so.
All right. And so that's the question I was asking, and you pointed me to Cronin. So go right ahead, Judge Bress. You had another question?
One other quick question would be on the unfair labor practice side of the house. Opposing counsel took the position that a union could not try to make these arguments through that in that context. Do you agree with that?
So
in other words, could a union not say an unfair labor practice is another agency, you know, taking control of the employing agency and usurping its authority? That's an unfair labor practice. Is that argument one that can be vindicated or considered there?
I agree that, as Your Honor framed it, is not an unfair labor practice under Section 7116. Now, in the complaint, this is at ER 81, paragraphs 146 to 147, the plaintiffs also allege that they were prevented by these terminations from their core functions of representing employees in federal bargaining units, in collective bargaining, and providing counseling, advice, and representation. Again, this is paragraphs 146 to 147 of the Third Amendment complaint. And so to the extent that that is plaintiff's allegation, that they were prevented from representing employees, that is absolutely an unfair labor practice.
Okay, I understand the distinction.
Anything further? No, I don't think we have anything further. I'm going to thank all counsel for your helpful advocacy. We'll take this matter under advisement and stand in recess.